Well, I appreciate Jimmy leading songs this morning that have continued the theme of our summer Bible studies, in which many of us have had the joy of participating in throughout this past week. And especially appreciate him leading that great song that Matt Harbor wrote for us as our theme song this week for our summer studies. For the last several years, Matt has been so gracious as to write an original song for us to use that keys on the idea of the theme of our studies, and as usual, he provided us a really good song this year, and I think we all enjoyed singing it through the week, and glad that we got to sing it together as a congregation this morning. James chapter 2 and verse 10. James says, "Whoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble in one point, he is guilty of all." I want us to think for a few minutes together this morning about the point that is made in this passage. I think it is a very important point, but it is a point that is very often misunderstood and misapplied. And so I want us to think both about what this verse does not say and what it does say. And I want to gather together those thoughts under the title, Cafeteria-Style Religion. Cafeterias are not as popular as they used to be. I can remember a day when it was really a special thing to go to Morrison's or Piccadilly or Luby's, if you're a Texan. Luby's is still the best of the best as far as cafeterias go, I think. Not as many people enjoy that kind of dining experience as used to be the case, but most people understand the concept of a cafeteria. That's a place where you go down the line and you pick which foods you want and leave alone those that you don't want. And so cafeteria-style religion would be the kind of religion in which we pick and choose which parts of God's will we want to do, and we just leave the others off. When God instructed Saul in 1 Samuel to go and slay all of the Amalekites in punishment for what they had done to Israel years before, Saul chose to do most of what he was commanded to do, but the presumptuous attitude which caused him to think that he could set aside some parts of his instruction and not do those things was described by God as rebellion. 1 Samuel chapter 15. Saul was practicing what I'm going to call this morning cafeteria-style religion. He seemed to think that he could do some of what God said, but if there were parts of it that he found objectionable or parts of it in which he thought he had a better idea, that he was free to alter God's instructions. I one time heard a preacher call this kind of a thing selective service. In service to the Lord, we select what we want to do. But we are not at liberty to pick and choose which parts of God's will we prefer to do. James says, "Whoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble in one point, he is guilty of all." Think about what James 2 verse 10 does not say. James does not mean here that no matter how hard we try to be faithful to the Lord, if we inadvertently slip up even in one point, that we are no different in God's eyes than the worst sinner on the face of the earth. That anybody who commits any kind of a sin is all classified as wickedness in God's terms. And this verse says that whoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble or fall short in one point, he is guilty of all. The passage can't mean that because there are too many passages that make a clear distinction between the righteous and the wicked. Paul in Romans chapter 6, for example, clearly distinguishes between those who yield themselves submissively to God's will as opposed to those who rebel and have no concern to keep God's will. In Revelation chapter 3 and verse 4, when the Lord wrote to the church in Sardis, for the most part, the church in Sardis had become unfaithful to the Lord. Faithful to the Lord. They were not righteous people, but the Lord said in Sardis there were a few who had not soiled their garments. Well, there wasn't anybody in the church in Sardis who was perfect. The Lord said some of them still had clean garments as far as he was concerned. They had not defiled themselves. So we're not taught here that it doesn't matter how hard you try. If you ever fall short in one thing, then you may as well just give it all up and go into a completely wicked lifestyle. What it does mean is that God gave all of His will, and we don't have the prerogative to do what Saul did, and that is just disregard some of our instructions arbitrarily, as if we could keep part of it and just leave the rest undone. James is talking about the problem of an attitude that sees itself as being above the law. He says we need to be under the law as keepers of the law, but if we pick and choose which parts of God's will we think have to be kept and which parts don't have to be kept, then he said that makes us judges of the law, where we can judge what is significant and what is not significant. And so it turns the tables. Rather than the law being here and we're under the law, it puts us in a position of being over the law, which is not ever what was intended to be. Perhaps we think sometimes that if we obey God in most things, then that gives us enough credit that we can disregard some of the things because we've, after all, done most of what God wanted in the rest of our lives. Well, the Lord talked in Matthew chapter 7 in the Sermon on the Mount about the lawless attitude, the rebellious attitude of the person who may have done many things in the Lord's name, but their attitude was that they didn't believe they had to do anything they didn't want to do. Matthew 7, verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. That is the person who submissively yields to God's will, regardless of whether God's will is pleasant or pleasing or not. Many, he said, will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name and cast out demons in your name and done many wonders in your name? Have we not built up enough credit, Lord, that you could excuse us from having disregarded your will over here? No, I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. These are the very kinds of people that James was talking about. He said that some see themselves as judges of God's law. We just don't have to do that because, after all, we've done these things over here. That's an attitude that is the attitude of an outlaw. Ever think about what the word outlaw means? It means a person who thinks he's outside the limits of the law. He doesn't have to do anything he doesn't want to do. I put it this way. You can imagine a filter. What we do sometimes is to pass God's will through a filter, and the filter may be what we prefer to do, or what we think is good, or what we understand, all of these different criteria. Here's God's law, and it passes through this filter, and the only things that get through on the other side, the only things that we do are the things that have not been filtered out by our pleasure and our understanding and our think-sos. But you know what the problem is with filters? Use them long enough, they clog up so that nothing gets through. You notice that with the air filter in your air conditioning system? You don't change it often enough. Not enough air is going to be getting through of any kind. More will be filtered out than you want to be. Well, that's the problem. Even if you have a filter that lets 99% of God's will through, if you just arbitrarily think you can disregard the 1%, then you're setting up a situation later on when you will have a lawless attitude that feels free to disregard all of God's law if that's what you want to do. Consider Noah in the book of Genesis, chapter 6, when he was commanded to build the ark. There were several things about the ark that God said to Noah. It was to be of gopher wood. It would have three decks that had compartments to them with pitch, perhaps some kind of tar-like substance inside and out. It was to be 300 cubits long by 50 cubits by 30 cubits. It was to have a window and a door. Genesis 6:22 says after Noah had carried out the instructions that he had done according to all that God commanded him. But suppose Noah had filtered out some parts of God's instructions. If he had kept 80% of what God had said, but he disregarded the other 20%, the results likely would have been disastrous. Fact is, we can't build up extra credit with God by obeying some of what He commands right now so that we can later disregard His will when we wish. Listen, If we set aside any of God's will just because we don't think it has to be done, then at those times when we are doing what God has commanded, we're really not obeying God. We're just doing what we think is a good idea. That's not His will, it's ours, as evidenced by the fact that when there's a difference between His will and ours, we do ours rather than His. That's an indication that even when we're doing God's will, it's not because it's His will, it's just because that seems okay to us. It suits our preference. That's a lawless attitude. That's being a judge over God's will. So what does James say? We disregard any part of God's will as if we were not obligated to keep that part, then that's to be a transgressor of the law, and you may as well just throw the whole law away. What James is recommending, of course, is an attitude of unqualified obedience to God. Unreserved obedience, no strings attached submission to what God says. The only thing that needs to be clear is that that's what God has commanded. But if we're sure this is God's will, then it doesn't really matter, does it? Whether we understand why that should be the Lord's will, or whether it pleases us to do that, whether it fits our lifestyle or our schedule or anything else. The only thing that matters is whether thus saith the Lord. And if the Lord's will is such and such a thing, then we need to have an unreserved commitment to do it. Period. Matthew 22, verse 37, Jesus said He wants us to love Him with all of our heart and all of our soul and all of our mind. Amaziah was said in 2 Chronicles chapter 25 and verse 2 that he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, but not with a loyal heart, not with a whole heart. I think that's the way many people are, maybe including ourselves some of the time. Generally known to be obedient people, but in the hard matters, you can never be sure. We might and we might not do God's will when push comes to shove. A lot of commendable things about Amaziah, but what a sad statement for the Lord to have to make that he didn't serve with a loyal heart. It is possible, however, to have the kind of heart that Amaziah didn't have. We read about Joshua and Caleb in Numbers chapter 32, verses 11 and 12, that they followed the Lord completely. Look at it. Numbers 32, verses 11 and 12. Surely none of the men who came up from Egypt from 20 years old and above shall see the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because they have not wholly followed me, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua, the son of Nun, for they have wholly followed the Lord. That didn't mean they were perfect. There are no sins in their lives. It meant that they didn't have any strings attached to their commitment to the Lord's will. They didn't have their hand behind their back with their fingers crossed when they said that they were going to obey the Lord. The Lord gave instructions. These two men could be counted on to carry out those instructions. Seems to me that that was the difference between David and Saul. And God took away the kingdom from Saul because he didn't have an unreserved commitment to carry out the Lord's instructions. The Lord said, I'm going to find a man who has my kind of heart, a man after my own heart. And David was that kind of man. Wasn't that David was perfect? He committed some horrible sins. But when God gave instructions, David could be counted on to carry out those instructions, all of them, whether they suited David or not. That's the kind of people God's looking for. Josiah, one of the later kings of Judah, very commendable statement made about him in 2 Kings chapter 23 and verse 25. Speaking of Josiah, now before him there was no king like him who turned to the Lord with all his heart, with all his soul, and with all his might, according to all the law of Moses, nor after him did any arise like him. I believe this is a part of what the Lord had in mind in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 8 when he talked about being pure in heart. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. To love the Lord with a pure heart means that we've given Him all of our hearts. And when He commands, we get busy obeying the command without picking and choosing like we do at the cafeteria. Well, let me make a few just practical applications of this principle. Ask some questions. For example, when we come together to worship as we have this morning, do we think that we can pick and choose which parts of the worship assembly apply to us and which don't? Colossians chapter 3 and verse 16 says that we are to sing. It amazes me that I sometimes glance around and see during the worship assembly that some are not singing. I don't want to be judgmental. It might be in a given instance that somebody is sick with a bad sore throat, or there may be some instance in that particular moment why they would not be singing, but they otherwise would be. But I think I know people who just typically don't feel like they need to sing in the assembly. Well, that has been commanded as much as anything else. Do we think that just we can just leave that off if we don't enjoy singing, or we don't think we have a good voice, if we're not in the mood to sing? Would we leave the Lord's Supper off if we didn't like grape juice, if we weren't in the mood to have the Lord's Supper at a particular moment? What gives us the right to say that one part of the Lord's commands with respect to the assembly is important and has to be done, but there's some parts of it that I just don't have to pay any attention to because I don't like that? Well, that's just an example of the kind of application that this principle might make. What about the work of the local congregation? Do we think there's some parts of what the Lord has instructed His people to be busy doing that we just don't need to even be concerned about because we don't like that? And Paul certainly says in 1 Corinthians 12 and Romans 12 that the body is not made up of one member but many, and all of us will have certain specific things that we are to specialize in because we have some unique ability and interest in those areas. But I don't understand the attitude of a person who, without regard to abilities and interest and special service and all of that, would just identify some part of what the congregation is doing and say, I'm not interested in that, I don't need to think about that, I don't need to be involved in that at all. Some things all of us do better, than relatively speaking, than we do other things. But it seems to me, if somebody comes to us and says, we need some help doing this or that in the Lord's work, would you help with this? Why would I ever say no to that? Does it matter whether I think I can do a good job of that? If I did that, I would really shine and people would compliment me for how I did that. And if I couldn't do it as well as somebody else does it, then I'm not going to do it because I don't want to suffer by comparison to the way somebody else. All of those are irrelevant considerations. Most of them come from pride. There's a need that somebody else, maybe one of our brothers or sisters, thinks that we can fill in the congregational work. We may not feel like we're the best person to do it, but it may be we're the only person who's in line to do it, and we just need to get in there and do the best we can. Trust that the Lord can bring some good results, even out of very feeble efforts that we all sometimes make. Do we have the attitude that we can just leave off some parts of the work that we are to be doing as a body? What about this one? I know some people who think that the will of our elders, whom the Lord has placed over us in this congregational relationship, just can be ignored if somebody doesn't like them. It's usually people who wouldn't, you know, who readily admit that the Lord expects us to submit to civil authority, wouldn't just disregard the laws of the land, and that the Lord has placed some authority in families. Why is it, when it comes to the authority that the Lord has placed in the congregational relationship, we sometimes think we can just leave that off? Their opinion, they have a right to their opinions, but I don't have to do anything they ask me to do if I don't want to. Well, would we take that attitude in regard to other forms of authority? Probably not. Are we selective about which sins we will avoid? Look at it. There's several lists of sins in the New Testament. Look at the one in Romans chapter 1, where Paul is, I think, describing the pagan Gentile world of his day. But listen to this list of sins. Some of them are obviously horrible sins, aren't they? Heinous acts of immorality. Others are sins, but they are a little bit more respectable, aren't they? Start at verse 29. Being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful. Quite a list, isn't it? What kind of attitude would it betray if we thought, well, yeah, homosexuality is a horrible thing, and idolatry and all of those sorts of things, but oh, a little deceit once in a while is just a part of the human condition. Or a little envy is not such a terrible thing. Disobeying parents, certainly not any big deal. Do we feel that there are any parts of God's will that we can just disregard? Are we selective about which sins to avoid? It is a fact, isn't it, that depending upon the age in which we live and the culture in which we live, there are certain sins that come to be thought of as being very serious sins, while other sins, equally condemned in God's Word, just don't have the social stigma to them that other sins have. And that changes over time. As the centuries come and go, and nations rise and fall, and cultures change, things that at one point in history, at one place in time, would have been considered very horrible, might not be by another generation. And things are now considered horrible, but maybe didn't used to be very horrible years ago. Isn't it a fact that all of us are creatures of the culture in which we live to the extent that we are conditioned to think that certain things are very serious, not because God's Word says they are more serious than other things, but simply because for social and cultural reasons, those are just have a social stigma attached to them, and we'll stay far away from those. I seem to have very little concern about other things that from God's standpoint are equally serious, if not more so, but because they don't have a strong social stigma to them at this time, it just didn't seem like those are anything more than just little foibles that almost everybody has. And so why make a big deal of it? Well, what are the sins that really distress you when you see them in other people's lives? What are the sins that really distress you when you see them in your life? Is it not a fact that we very often pat ourselves on the back a little bit because we don't do some of the things that the wicked people do? And then we'll turn right around and almost excuse certain sins in our lives, equally sinful, but we're just not as concerned about those things. James chapter 2 has some important things to say to us about not having this cafeteria-style religion, this pick-and-choose attitude. Obedience to God is not a partial endeavor. The gospel, Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 5, intends to bring every thought into captivity to Christ. More and more, I make a part of my daily prayer life, a sincere prayer for the Lord to help me see the things about my life that are as serious as He sees them to be. Lord, uncover my secret faults. Uncover the things that I need to repent of, but I just haven't been seeing that was a very serious matter. Help me to see what you see about my life and help me to bring every thought into captivity. Not just the ones that seems to me need to be captive to Christ, but all of them. God is the God of all of His will, and we can't disregard any of it without disregarding God Himself. You kept 99% of the Lord's will, but with 1% of it, you had the attitude which says, I don't think I have to do that, and I won't do that. then what you have done is not to show disregard to God's commandments, you've shown disregard to God Himself. By saying that you're more important than His will is, and you can pick and choose what you want to do and what you don't want to do. We need to live, as James says in chapter 2 and verse 12, as those who will be judged by the law of liberty. And we need, as Jesus said in Matthew 22, to love the Lord our God with all of our heart and with all of our soul, with all of our mind. It becomes harder, doesn't it, as the years go by, to continue to work on these things. When we first become Christians, perhaps we all are conscious of many changes that need to be made. But after we've made all the big ones, you know, we picked all the low-hanging fruit, and now we'd have to climb up into the tree to pick the rest of the fruit. It's tendency to just stay on the ground and say, well, I've done most of the repenting that I need to do. Well, that's just where it really gets interesting. When we've cut all the rough stuff that obviously needed to be cut out of our lives, and then we're down to those little respectable sins that nobody's going to think much less of if we do those. We can't afford to leave those out. So until we die, we need to be committed to a greater and greater obedience to the Lord, wholehearted obedience that will leave no stone unturned in our effort to be exactly what the Lord wants us to be. If you're here this morning and we can assist you in taking some public step of obedience, we'd love to do that. We'd encourage you to have the courage to take that decision now before even another hour goes by. All we can do is encourage you, but we'd like to do that. The song that we sing, we hope, will stir you up and make you want to ask us for our assistance. If we can help you in any way, won't you come while we stand and sing?